Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Linda Rosenberg, CEO of the National Council for Behavioral Health, dedicated to unifying the voice of America's healthcare organizations who deliver mental health and addiction treatment services. They've just released a study in partnership with the Cohen Veterans Network that shows America's mental health crisis is a direct result of lack of access to mental health and addiction services. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also ask Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Linda Rosenberg on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Linda Rosenberg, President and CEO of the National Council for Behavioral Health, seeking to unify the voice of America's healthcare organizations who deliver mental health and addiction treatment and services. Under her leadership, the National Council advanced the passage of the Mental Health Parity Act in 2008 and also launched the Mental Health First Aid Initiative. Prior to joining the National Council, Ms. Rosenberg was Senior Deputy Commissioner of the New York State Office of Mental Health, where she implemented New York's first mental health court. She's a member of the Executive Committee of the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention. She earned her MSW from Adelphi University. Linda, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, I don't know if Americans know this factoid, but 20 to 25% of Americans have a diagnosable mental health condition in a given year. But a majority never seek or gain access to that treatment, and for a variety of reasons. And your organization, in partnership with the Cohen Veterans Network, just released a report, I think it was October 10th, that reveals a distinct connection between the lack of available behavioral health and addiction services and the mental health crisis we're seeing in the country. There are just so few treatment options available to those suffering with behavioral health or addiction crisis. I wonder if you could share with our listeners more about the study and what it revealed to you.
Yeah, so it revealed some interesting things, some things we suspected, but it was good to have them validated. You know, you have hunches, you want to make sure that there's data behind it. Mm-hmm. And what the survey showed is that 6 in every 10 Americans has looked for help for themselves or a loved one, which is a high number. And what it revealed is that 76% of Americans believe that mental health is as important as any medical or physical health condition you could have. It also, I think, interestingly enough, I hope put to rest the myth that stigma is the biggest barrier to treatment. Mm-hmm. You know, we had for a long time a belief that people didn't look for care because they were embarrassed and ashamed, and although there is still some of that left, in fact, the biggest barrier is people don't know where to go and they don't know how to pay for it. Mm-hmm.
Well, Linda, you know, thinking about this, we are very engaged in delivering healthcare, integrated primary care and behavioral health care here in Connecticut to about 100,000 people a year, and working with practices on practice transformation around the country. And I was so interested by that because I note that last year we saw about 100,000 people, and about 20% of them were seen in not just primary care, but also for behavioral health services. That's kind of right in line. Mm-hmm. With what you're showing, but
right.
It's still hard to wrap our minds around it, I think, when we think about the general population. And the National Council has noted that those people who are seeking treatment are now skewing to a younger age, and certainly, as we've all been recognizing, a significant percentage of veterans are among those who are seeking help. Tell us about these changing demographics.
Yeah.
and about the daunting barriers that still exist to gaining access. You say maybe stigma is reduced, but still sounds like a lot of daunting barriers to gaining access to this critical service.
definitely daunting barriers. Interesting enough, veterans were more likely to feel comfortable looking for help. And I think that's a testament really to the job the VA, Cone Veterans Network, and other veterans group have done really to destigmatize getting help for things like PTSD, depression, and anxiety. And so they are looking for care. Younger people is also interesting. I think anyone that has teenagers or that spends some time, you know, looking at these issues on the internet will see young people exchanging information very openly in ways we certainly didn't when I was a teen, talking about being diagnosed bipolar. A group of teens gave me a bipolar babe t-shirt a year or so ago. It wasn't, you know, a hidden secret. They were living with it and had learned to cope. So I think the other thing is people who are looking for treatment and who do get it are very satisfied. That was the other thing the survey showed, is that treatment is effective. People can get help. And we know that both from research studies, but we also now know it as a result of the survey.
Linda, that t-shirt was well-deserved, not only today, but looking at your leadership, the National Council helped realize the passage of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act back in 2008. We were fortunate to have Congressman Patrick Kennedy join us a few years later on the show, still lamenting the huge challenges in achieving true parity in the American
and
health
we-
system.
We work closely with Patrick. He is, you know, an American hero.
Oh, there's no question about
in
that.
In terms of the work he did and the work he does. And I think what we're seeing is parity has had an effect mostly on hospitals, residential treatment, beds, inpatient service. It's had less of an impact on community-based services, which, of course, for a chronic illness are part of the continuum. It's the way you avoid going into the hospital. And Patrick and many groups are still working to make sure that insurance departments in states enforce parity, that insurance companies understand their obligation, and that state legislation, many states have their own parity laws, are strong and support the federal law. So there's still much work to be done, but he hasn't stopped, and neither have the groups working
Neither have you, but you know, we've had some changes in that 10-year period. You'd have the Reauthorization Equity Act of 2016. You had the Affordable Care Act. How have those helped move the ball forward?
I think that the biggest success of the ACA, you know, others may disagree with me, has really been the expansion of Medicaid. What that has resulted in is people with addictions getting treatment who could not get any care before at all. You know, you didn't qualify for Medicaid or for Social Security income because an addiction was your primary disorder. That had happened in the 80s or 90s. And so when states expanded Medicaid and it just became an income test, then people with addiction started to get the help they desperately need. And during the time of an opioid epidemic, certainly resulting in so many overdose deaths, this has been a major success. So I'd say the Medicaid expansion has happened with after once it's done in a state and the political posturing is over, there's been little fuss or muss, and people have gotten care who didn't have care before.
That is such a good point, and we couldn't agree with you more. You know, but outside of some of our more formal systems, I would love for you to have a chance to talk about what I think one of your truly wonderful and ingenious grassroots efforts launched by the National Council, and that's the Mental Health First Aid Initiative. This is a program that is aimed at providing everyday people, including teachers and first responders, veterans, really anybody, I guess, with the training and the skill set necessary to recognize and to respond in an appropriate way to signs of mental health or addiction problems. You've got a great tagline, anyone, anywhere can make a difference. And I understand over a million people have been trained through the program. So talk for our listeners about the genesis of this mental health first aid, what the training is all about, what the results have achieved so far, and what are you thinking about for its future?
Yeah, no, it is, it's really opportunity meets being prepared to take advantage of opportunity. We heard about it on a phone call back in 2007. It was a program that started in Australia. It's now in 24 countries. And, you know, I just love the idea of mental health first aid. You know, I'm somebody who's been trained in CPR and first aid, and I thought, why not? You know, I'm much more likely to see someone in emotional distress mm-hmm. than someone having a coronary event. And yet few people feel comfortable in dealing with mental illnesses, everything from addictions to anxiety and to, you know, people thinking of taking their own lives, of suicide. And so I, you know, took a course. We had staff take a course, and we all said, hey, this is really outstanding. We had the people from Australia come over, Tony Jorm and Betty Kirchner, and we began to roll it out. And I think what's really special about it is it teaches you to have these uncomfortable conversations, to listen non-judgmentally, but also because it's taught by local instructors, and there are about 14,000 instructors in the U.S. You've got to teach at least 3 classes a year to keep your certification as an instructor, because it's taught by local people. They know the resources in their community, and they're able, as part of the course, to let people know where you can go to get some help, whether it's a 1-800 hotline, or it's a mental health clinic, or it's a primary care doc who does collaborative care, which means he has access right in his office to behavioral health specialists. So that is very exciting. It's well researched as compared to many other, you know, literacy programs. This has a strong research base. Most recently, a piece of research came out here out of Colorado and the university there that shows that people retain the gains they make even 6 months later and continue to use the skills that they were taught. And that's exciting for us. Mm-hmm. We do have other plans. We're looking towards putting part of it online so people can both do part of the work in their comfort of their own homes, but part of it will continue to be live with a group, because so much rich exchange goes on when people interact together and share their own stories. We're looking at a teen version, and we're excited that about 1.4 million people have taken the course, either to work with youth or to work with adults. So it's been, you know, a major success, and we're very lucky at the National Council that our board has invested heavily in this and believes it's their obligation to make sure we have an educated public. I think that's part of the demand we're seeing. And now, of course, we have to make it as easy for them to get help. And that's the big hurdle now.
We're speaking today with Linda Rosenberg, President and CEO of the National Council for Behavioral Health, seeking to unify the voice of America's healthcare organizations who deliver mental health and addiction treatment services. Linda, I was thinking as you were talking about the collaborative care of the doc with the resource in his office, that the National Council has long advocated for embedding behavioral health services in primary care settings, and something that resonates with us and to many around the country. We had Tom McClellan, the CEO of Treatment Research Institute, who talked to us about the vital approach to managing chronic nature of substance abuse disorder over the long term, certainly includes integrating into primary care. And, you know, and it's such a challenge, I think. One would see that the best practice or the evidence base shows that it's important, but healthcare can sometimes be siloed and make it difficult. And I wonder if you could just talk about your research and advocacy in this area about embedding behavioral health in primary care.
It is difficult. It's a major change. Mental illness was always the purview of the state. State hospitals were far away in rural areas very often. It was not seen as part of general health care. so, you know, when the National Council got involved in this and began to think that this isn't right and many people aren't getting care, and when they're getting care in primary care, it isn't as good as it could be because the practitioners, you know, aren't trained and they have many other things they're attending to. And so we began to say things really do have to change. And I think we're seeing it slowly happen. The unfortunate thing is people use the word integration like they use the word recovery, like they use value-based purchasing to mean many things. And in some cases, what it's meant is the state has taken, you know, mental health money and merged it with general health care money and given it to, you know, a managed care company that's now responsible for so-called integrated care. And that's okay. The problem is it doesn't really integrate care on the ground. Mm-hmm. And the kind of, you know, collaborative care is slow. First of all, you've got to have a team approach. You have to have psychiatric consultation available, very often using telepsychiatry. You have to know how to bill for it. Medicare now has a code for collaborative care, but all of insurance has not caught up yet. So this is going to be a journey. It's a marathon, not a sprint, mm-hmm. but we can't take our foot off the gas pedal.
Well, Linda, Mark just referenced our interview with Dr. Tom McClellan, and he had brought up another astonishing statistic, which our provider teams say all the time, so this one didn't really astonish us, that very few health professionals have had any kind of formal training in addiction medicine in particular during their medical and health professions training. Certainly not so much in behavioral health generally, but in addiction, even less so. And that really was true of behavioral health as well as the medical and nursing people. Our research and education arm, which is our Weizmann Institute, often gets requests to help train staff in primary care organizations to be better prepared to address substance use disorder specifically, and of course, opioid use disorder specifically now, we have to say, in team-based primary care settings. What's the council's take on this or recommendation? Yeah. I know, you know, the Council on Graduate Medical Education is referenced in a number of the Mental Health Parity Acts. We've seen some progress about additional training for physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, behavioral health people around opioid use disorder. But what are you recommending needs to be done around the shift in general in education and training models for health professionals to make them better prepared to fill this gap?
Yeah, we of course totally agree, and for a number of years have actually been doing training in primary care around ESPERT, you know, the screening and brief intervention and treatment, which is evidence-based, trying to help primary care practices do that screening and do those brief interventions. It's been tough going. Tom is, of course, you know, a brilliant guy and totally right. You know, one of the things is we're getting some attention to this in medical schools and certainly psychiatric residency programs, but the biggest number of professionals that work in, you know, mental health and substance use organizations are social workers. And very little attention has been given to what can we do with social work curriculum so that it does include the treatment of addictive disorders. You know, alcohol is still the number one killer, and we shouldn't forget that. But I think, you know, it just has not caught up. We had been involved a number of years ago in curriculum change in schools of social work around integrated care. Mm-hmm. And I think now it's time to turn our attention really to addictive disorders. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to be a learning field, right? We
right.
need to always
Absolutely.
Be seeing what's the research telling us,
yep.
how do we train people, and then how do we change the practices, whether it's in primary care or even specialty care? You know, what has to change in the workflows to be able to incorporate these kinds of screenings, brief treatments, and then where do they send people who need specialty care? Do we have enough resources? So this is, you know, an evolution that we're all part of.
Linda, you've talked about your goals and that in an ideal world, there would be a mental health clinic in every neighborhood. And you've just sort of waxed eloquently about the change processes that need to go on and practices, the education that we need. And And then we need to send people who have problems to, maybe to specialists. And it was thinking about the conversations that we've had with Peter Yelalis, who was the president of the American Telemedicine Association, talking about his early work in Australia using telemedicine to address the gaps in behavioral health services across rural and low resources areas. And I'm wondering, and you talked earlier about telepsychiatry, I'm wondering what you see this emerging tech-based intervention doing in terms of transforming access across the country. And, you know, these aren't all necessarily always rural or frontier places. Sometimes in our inner cities, people do not have access to the specialty care they need. So where does behavioral health enter into your larger model that ultimately will end up with these mental health clinics, as in many neighborhoods, or a portal in every neighborhood?
Yes, totally agreed. You know, I don't even think it's that people don't have access. I think we're, you know, raising generations now that want things on demand, right? I'm waiting for an Amazon package as we talk. I just ordered yesterday.
Is it coming by drone or is it just coming?
Maybe. I don't really care as long as it gets here, right? I'm into being on demand and I like doing things from the comfort of my home. And so I think even for the most serious disorders, I was just on a call with Emory University, and they're looking at connecting people who are in the emergency room to community-based care. And we got into a major discussion about texting people and, emailing them and chatting over Skype, all of the things that state cannot do based on regulations, but all things that eventually we will do.
Sure.
You know, innovation always comes before regulatory change.
Right.
I think there will be a mix. We call it at the National Council high tech and high touch. For the last 10 years at our big annual conference, we've had a technology track. I must talk to two or three people who are, you know, backed by investor money, mm-hmm. who have different kinds of technologies that they're introducing. I don't know if any are profitable yet. Because again, you know, who's going to pay for it and how it's going to be paid for. Michael Phelps is all over TV advertising Talkspace, where you can get evidence-based treatment, you know, via a Skype-like device. And I do think those things are going to be integrated in all of healthcare and specifically in mental health and addictions care.
Well, that is wonderful. And, you know, I do want to give a shout out to Veteran Affairs, who I understand have completed more than 2.5 million telehealth visits for mental health and particularly focused on PTSD. So really been great leaders in that area. We have been speaking today with Linda Rosenberg, the president and CEO of the National Council for Behavioral Health. You can learn more about their important work by going to thenationalcouncil.org or follow them on Twitter at National Council. Linda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In an op-ed for USA Today, President Donald Trump made several false and misleading claims about the Medicare for All Act, which was introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders in September 2017. The president claimed that the Medicare for All Act, one of several Democratic-sponsored health insurance bills, would, quote, cost an astonishing $32.6 trillion during its first 10 years. That's an estimate of the cost to the federal government that ignores the offsetting savings in health care costs for individuals, employers, and state governments. Overall, health expenditures would not increase by an estimated $32 trillion over a decade, as the claim suggests. Under the plan, health care spending would shift entirely to the federal government, while people, employers, and state governments would pay less for health care. Also, Trump wrote that the Medicare for All Act would, quote, take away benefits from seniors. The plan calls for adding new benefits to Medicare coverage, including dental, vision, and hearing aids, and eliminating deductibles. The president offers his opinion that it wouldn't work out that way, but the bill as written would provide more benefits, not take them away. Trump also overstates the consensus when he said Democrats across the country have been uniting around the Medicare for All Act. It's true that 16 Democrats in the Senate have co-sponsored Sanders' Medicare for All bill, and 123 Democrats in the House co-sponsored a similar measure introduced by former Representative John Conyers. But it's not clear that Democrats are uniting around that one proposal. Sanders' bill is one of a handful of proposals in Congress that would expand insurance coverage in various ways by increasing access to Medicare or Medicaid. For example, the Medicare X Choice Act would offer a public plan option based on Medicare through the Affordable Care Act's marketplace. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When it comes to walking the walk, Chester County, Pennsylvania is on it. To celebrate National Public Health Week, county health officials decided to issue a challenge to members of their community to log a collective billion steps last year.
Started with a National Association of County Officials conference in which they were announcing a national competition to improve health outcomes in cities and counties. So we applied for that while we were also trying to introduce more physical activity into our health department initiatives as a basis for healthy living.
Jean Kasner, director of the Chester County Health Department, says they launched the program WalkWorks Chest Co., creating a website for county residents to log their daily steps, to join walking groups, issue challenges, and get entire families and neighborhoods involved with this simple goal: walk for better population health.
Really a model for getting individuals up and walking that takes multiple approaches and hopefully starts to inspire that next generation to be walking, and also getting the current generations up and walking with something simple.
Communities, schools, companies, all engaged in walking challenges, and it led to far more people participating throughout the county.
So we actually have a website where people can go and check how many steps and how many walkers and look at competitions. That's really what starts to spur it. And then having a couple trusted organizations participate in a walk and putting a little visibility, getting the newspaper out there to write a little piece on it. It doesn't have to be countywide, and that's the beauty of walking.
In just 6 months, some 3,000 participants were able to log over a billion steps, having reached their goal far more easily than they originally thought. Kasner says since it's a two-year program, they actually had to increase their goals to keep people walking.
So last year, we accumulated about $1.7 billion. Our goal was $1 billion, so we exceeded that. And we reached about 2,800 walkers. This year's goal is to walk a cumulative of 5 billion steps. We took a look at the data and said, we have a lot of steps. We don't have enough people. So in a county of 515,000 plus residents, so we pushed it up to 5,000. Fitbits and other wearables, including your mobile phone, because you don't actually have to wear anything. Most of the mobile phones come with an automatic health-related app on it that tracks steps. It helps individuals because not only is it cool to have something tracking without you not even having to put any effort to it, but it also starts to create some of that mechanism where we can collect all the data, socialize it, and actually increase social interaction. So part of the value of walking is its social and emotional value. So you then get to participate in the social media aspects of it, and it really starts to get people excited and motivated.
A community-wide effort leveraging the power of public and government entities to engage the community in a collective health and wellness program, creating a user-friendly website for participants to engage with one another, making it fun, yielding an increase in healthy exercise across the population. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.